I'm Garth Graham, the chairman of the UConn section of the University of Canada North. The reason we're starting a couple minutes late tonight is because of difficulties in getting our speakers to come to the table, and also the fact that one of them hasn't shown up yet. So that person will get to speak last. Tonight, we're going to be in the second session of Future Projections Post-Settlement, and we'll be looking at the question of social change. I would like to take a few minutes, particularly for those of you who have sat through all four forums, to talk a little bit about how we put them together and why we put them together. The initial idea for a public information forum on land claims actually came from Ray Jackson of YNB, and we began talking about it in August of 1976. So it took about 14, 15 months to put together. And the money that we used to put it together came basically from a Secretary of State grant that we applied for in March and received in May of this year, and that was for the tune of $5,000. And I just want to read to you from the objectives page that we put in that grant application to give you some idea what our intent was. It read, "Land claims is one means by which two cultures are meeting and attempting to work out future directions. A concern for the future of the Yukon as a workable society is inherent in the theme which initiated this process, Together Today for Our Children Tomorrow. The basic idea behind a series of public information forums on Yukon land claims is to provide concerned citizens with an opportunity to talk with each other. The assumptions underlying this idea are as follows: that there are very rapid positive social changes taking place on many levels in the Yukon Indian community, that anyone, but more particularly the white community, has little opportunity to perceive the effects of these changes, that out-of-date or inaccurate information on both sides can create fear, hostility, and inappropriate stereotypes, and that accurate, up-to-date information is necessary for informed decision-making, that the basic problem in cross-cultural communication is not lack of information, but what happens when you get it." And following from these assumptions, we stated three objectives: to provide an opportunity for concerned members of the public to integrate information through a process of using it. And I think that will explain to you the structure that we've used, which is panel such as this, followed by group discussion, followed by a question period. To assist in the identification of areas of public concern and of questions which the general public want answers. In the process of putting together a proceedings coming out of this, as you can tell, we've collected the information that has come forward from in a variety of different manners, and we hope to be able to assess some of the areas in which there are public concerns and record them and make the information available. And our final objective was to contribute in some part to positive changes in attitude. Frankly, I doubt our ability to evaluate whether we've created any positive changes in attitude, but we'll certainly be thinking about it. Just a brief note on the organization of the forums, because I think it's helpful to see what goes into something like this, to see what you've been a part of. The putting these forums on has involved over 62 people, and I don't mean audience, I mean in the planning and the organization. There are 15 members of the University of Canada North Board of Directors, and they've all been involved in discussing the objectives, applying for grants, reviewing progress. There's an advisory board of 12 people that consists of a variety of different Whitehorse community organizations who actually designed the process. Then once we had that up and running and we had a project coordinator hired, we began to get group discussion leaders and group recorders, and there were 20 of those. And then there have been 15 people on the panels, and that comes to 62. The total budget for these forums is $7,300. only 5,000 of which we have so far, so we're still looking for an additional 2,300. That comes to advertising, the utilization of all this audiovisual hardware, travel for people from outside the Yukon, hall rental, coffee, cookies, and the major cost has been a project coordinator. Now, the person that we've hired has been introduced several times. He's probably out of sight at the moment taking care of some arrangements. And he'll be showing up a little later in the program again, and that's Mr. Rob Hornsey. He's been, is Rob in sight? Well, there he's from my sight line, he's behind a speaker. Rob is a field worker for Frontier College, and he's been in the Yukon since early spring, and he felt, and I felt, that when we began discussing this project together, that it would suit Frontier College's purposes to find out what kind of role they should be playing in the Yukon to be participant in this. And because of his background in community development and adult education throughout the North, that he had particular skills to offer to the project. And I would like to say that that, from my point of view as chairman of UCN, has been a very successful find on our part. I think he's done a phenomenal job. All of the meetings with those 62 people behind the scenes have been just as much an informing process and a learning process as have these public meetings. And so the whole thing, putting it together, making it happen, as well as the events themselves, have contributed to the process of informing. And that is Rob's skill and something that he's done very well. In the future, just to conclude, coming out of this, we are hoping to be able to acquire the means to publish a proceedings, and we are hoping to be able to use both the video and the audio in rebroadcast. Both of those depend on a bit of scrambling. We have to meet our deficit first and then see where we can go, but that's what we hope to do next. One thing that I meant to mention in terms of the process and haven't is the people that you see operating cameras and operating tapes. Two of them, I'd just like to identify them for you and also give them some recognition for showing up. I know that making all this gear work without someone tripping over the plugs or blowing all the fuses is almost impossible. And I can assure you that the fuses have blown many times, but somehow or other they've kept it all wired together and rolling forward. There's Bob McLaren and Henry Mitchell of CYI with the video, and Conrad Kordowski, Jenny Jack, and Ed Vance from Yaseto, the Native Communications Society. Now, tonight, the person who is going to moderate the panels is Mr. Doug Bell, who's the Assistant Commissioner for the Government of the Yukon Territory. So, Doug, I'll just let you go forward, and you can get me out of here.
Thank you, Garth. Hello. My job is quite easy. I'm simply going to introduce the speakers and hope that the third speaker will show, because at the present time we only have two. And after the question period, I'm going to act as moderator for you. The first speaker is certainly well known to everyone, and he comes to you with a substantial background for speaking on such a subject. He's the former chairman of the CYI, and you all know Daniel Johnson, but he's also former chief of the Kalani Tribal Brotherhood, former director of cultural education for the Yukon Native Brotherhood, and land claims researcher on community positions. And he's presently a member of the board of directors of the CYI. Daniel, welcome, and it's all yours.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the first time I was ever on a panel where we got all one side of the show sewed up here. So, with that in mind, We'll do our best to tell you our story. I've been asked to do this presentation, and as you had heard, it has to do with, well, projections as to how some of us might see them in respect of education with and after the land claims. And this afternoon, I was being very loyal and choosing for the West, and it doesn't pay because the West lost, and so I lost my bet, so I'm not here, and I don't feel very charitable. I'm going to be talking about the Department of Education somewhat, and then somewhat of our schemes for after the land claims, and as such, one cannot always be, I suppose, as positive as one should be. Okay, in education and the land claims, the basic problem which Indian people experience who are concerned with the education of their children is the utter lack of education monies not being allocated to culturally related curricula and instruction for Indian students. And this is not because there exists a dearth of money in the system being allocated to education. Rather, it is the lack of awareness springing from gross insensitivities of responsible political figures and administrators, resulting in token policies and less than half-truths about what our great fathers are doing for our children in the field of cultural, social, political, economical, and environmentally relevant education. The Department of Education this year is spending $12.4 million for the operation, maintenance, and a bit of capital expenditures, of which $9.8 million is spent on all public schools. I think we all feel fortunate that there is this kind of money and time being spent for the education of children in the Yukon. But I think what we as Indian people are saying is that for our children, that's not good enough. We're not saying that's not enough money. We're saying that the approach is just not good enough. With all due respect, I recognize the work that's being done. I think we would be in a very sad state if we didn't have the services that we do have. However, we like to look at it in a way which is not very comfortable for some people sometimes. Perhaps the policy of the Department of Education is that, to leave well enough alone. However, it is our belief that we must strive to make the system better, namely to have more open, more sensitive policies for the cultural education of Indian students so that there can be ongoing curriculum development in languages, physical and spiritual cultures, and in the legislation of applicable ordinances. And I'd just like to deviate a little bit and talk about population figures in the Yukon. Just all for the purpose of making a point. The exact population of the Yukon is somewhat contentious, as Statistics Canada will maintain that there are approximately 22,000 people here in the Yukon, and the government of the Yukon says there are more, something like 24,000. All the while, the approximately 4,500 Indians enrolled in the land claims see themselves continually becoming a more and more small minority. We see this happening in our own homelands. At any rate, demographic studies carried out by the Indian Minister's office indicated that 55% of the population of the Yukon are transient after 2 years. That would leave approximately 45% who stay longer than 2 years, some being permanent residents. 20 to 25% of these are Indians, permanent residents. And this Indian group, which represents approximately more than half of the permanent residents of the Yukon receives negligible consideration in the education policies and ordinances of our government. This is a definite indication that the priorities for the evolution of the education system are lacking. And what I'd like to do now, having just explained basically what we feel about the system, what's there and what isn't there, I'd like to turn our minds to what we would like to see in the Yukon after the land claims. Right now, negotiations are taking place between government and the Indian people on a land claim. And one of the critical areas of this land claims is the area of programs. And as you know, as citizens of this country, we all get programs through the government. It's all taxpayers' money. We work, pay taxes to the government, and the government redistributes that wealth. And I'm sure it's a very common practice in many countries. I know as Indian people, we had a system of taxing, and we call that sharing, where in the Indian economy of yesterday, Indians who, well, hunters, bring back game were required by their chief and their society, their culture, to share that game amongst its people. And so there's a distribution and a redistribution of wealth taking place. At any rate, programs are important, and as we see it under the land claims, the Indian people should not have to pay for programming out of their land claims money, because for a start, programs are benefits that citizens all across Canada receive anyway, and what we are simply trying to do is attempting to make those programs that are coming to us more relevant to our society, to our culture, to our environment, to our political way of thinking, our social attitudes, and the like. And under programs, the most important program of Indian people is education. My grandmother, who probably never had a day in school, but she lived a wonderful life she had many very human experiences, as would be expected, and as such would be equal to anyone here or anyone else in the world in that regard, realized and showed to me her concern for education. This was an 85-year-old Indian woman. Never saw a day of school. She lived on the land, had many hard times, had many good times, like many of us. Yet she expressed to me her concern and her awareness of the importance of education, and particularly in a changing society, which was making a transition from what we call today the traditional life of Indian people into this modern day world. I was told to stick to school and hang in there, because perhaps you realize that her world was changing very rapidly, and there was very little that can be done about it. And the best that anyone can do is to learn that system and to use that system for the best and betterment of your people. So, in education now, starting from the very young, the most important thing to us right now is our languages. The Indian languages spoken in the communities around the Yukon are still very much alive. But the problem is that it's not the young people who are speaking it, who many of us feel should be the ones to know their languages, but it's the older generation who were here before the coming of the Alaska Highway, before the building of that highway, and the people who were born around that time, who are still into their language and the beliefs of their culture, their society. And there are many reasons why this is the situation, but I'm not here to talk about that tonight. I like to keep the approach positive, and so we'll leave the missionaries out of this. Okay, so starting with the very young, what we would like to see is, for example, nurseries, or what they call day schools, or day nurseries, kindergarten and the grade, say, 1 to 3 level. There are many of us who feel that the education of our young should take place in our own community. That is best. That is preferable. Okay, education of the young can still continue in the existing facilities that we have, but the only way that can happen meaningfully is if that the curriculum and the attitudes in that system are changed or modified somewhat to suit the needs, the cultural, educational needs of Indian people, Indian students. And I think we realize that a lot of a lot of the education that is going to reach the younger children can only be achieved if we can educate our older people, parents, grandparents, about what the system is about. You know, what is it exactly that the public schools are teaching our children? Many Indian people don't know that simply because they do not have the formal education. They never had the opportunity that the children were experiencing. So the kids are learning a lot more of other things and learning less and less of who they are and where they come from, what their language is, what their beliefs and customs are. I mean, some of those things get transmitted just by way of a child's personal experiences, you know, hearing the language and, say, having a passive knowledge of his language, or watching potlatches and seeing the interchange between the moieties, the Crow and the Wolf clan, or moiety. And those types of cultural elements get transmitted to the child, but that's not enough. The parents don't know enough about what's happening in the education system. The education system doesn't know enough about what's happening in the communities. They don't know what's happening in the child's life. And I think educators have a responsibility to the children and to those children's parents and to that community in general. They have that responsibility. And it's up to those teachers to assume responsibility for what they are teaching and what they are doing. A friend of mine pointed out to me that one of the things he noticed about teachers was that with the salary that a teacher is getting, what's happening is that that teacher, that person, is utilizing, I suppose, his creative abilities by, say, buying good things for himself or whatever. But I think, and also the point to make is that many teachers' jobs stop at 3:30 or 4:15, and then that's it. Kids are gone and they're out of your hair, and that's it. I don't want to see them till tomorrow. Well, maybe sometimes kids can drive teachers up the wall like that. But if we think about ourselves as being teachers and whether we're in it, like what are our motives for being teachers? Are we teachers because we have a sense of responsibility to the younger generation, to the next generation? Or are we teachers simply because it's a good way to make a living? I mean, you know, it's a good job. You can, except that's not such a good argument anymore because there are thousands of unemployed teachers these days. Anyway, basically, what's needed, and you know, this doesn't cost much money. It costs in time and it costs in manpower. But in relation to the overall budget of the territorial government, which I said was $12.3 million in the last year, if one were to set aside 3 or even 5% of that budget, or even less, I mean, like the French language program has quite a bit of money. I mean, they get it from all over the place. You know, and I don't see why the same type of arrangement shouldn't be available for Indian people who want to see language development for their children. Language development, literacy, reading and writing, spelling, writing literature, documenting creation myths, the cosmology that Indian people believe in. And with that amount of money set aside to be used to promote curriculum development in those areas of language and the arts and the culture, you see, maybe that's just the way the system works. You have to fight it. You have to keep goading it. You have to keep sticking and being a thorn in it. And you know, because if the system is running along nicely and everyone is becoming complacent, then, you know, there's no problem, you know. I mean, everything is going okay. But it isn't going okay because leaving well enough alone is stagnating. It's complacency. And so you always have to do one better. And so if someone were to ask me, well, what's the one better? Well, from the Indian point of view, I would say, well, continue the evolution of the development of education in the Yukon. You know, I mean, everything changes. There's no reason why the Department of Education can't change. I mean, everything else changes. in terms of our, let's say, call it more lofty dreams after the land claims, and I think we all are becoming aware that after the land claims, which is hopefully before the pipeline, there's going to be a lot of people here, a lot of people in the Yukon. You know, right now, let's say there are 22 or 24,000 people here in the Yukon. Well, maybe in 2 years' time, there is going to be 75 and 80,000 people. high unemployment in Canada. At any rate, those people are going to need a service. I mean, like, I think right now this town needs, well, the population is still small, but there still needs to be something in terms of higher education after grade 12 or after the Volk School or after a few years of work, you know, where people, you know, people can get in as mature students in universities. People want those kinds of things. People want to learn. People need to learn, frankly. And so we consider things like colleges or a university, and as a part of that kind of a complex, including say a campus. One of our most important concerns and our most immediate concerns is a training center. Because we realize a lot of our people need training. Maybe if other people realize that, we might see eye to eye in certain areas, but we need training in many areas. And so it's the kind of thing that we're thinking about and formulating our ideas, developing them so that we can achieve these kinds of ends with the land claims. You know, it's not, you know, what really gets to me is this really ignorant attitude that some people have that all the Indians are after is all the land and the money. And Indian people don't have dreams or aspirations that are gonna benefit anybody here in the Yukon. Because we sure as hell want to benefit ourselves. And I definitely would like to see us benefiting other people as well. I don't mean that we're going to carry anybody around after the land claims. I just mean that we would like to be a part of the better, the more positive development that takes place here in the Yukon after the land claims. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Daniel. Our second speaker, he works with 8 Northern Native organizations in the area of communications and Southern support. He is, among other things, a journalist and an author, has written 3 books. 2 of them, This Land Is Not For Sale, is the title of one. The other is Moratorium, and the third one was a technical volume. Coordinator for Project North, Mr. Hugh McCollum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you mentioned, I am a journalist. And as most of you know, journalists get all of their stories from usually reliable sources. My usually reliable sources in Whitehorse tell me that from time to time, Project North and the McCollum. As you mentioned, I am a.
He is, among other things, a journalist and an author, has written 3 books. 2 of them, This Land Is Not For Sale, is the title of one. The other is Moratorium, and the third one was a technical volume. Coordinator for Project North, Mr. Hugh McCollum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you mentioned, I am a journalist. And as most of you know, journalists get all of their stories from usually reliable sources. My usually reliable sources in Whitehorse tell me that from time to time, Project North and the McCollums and the things they write and the things they say are often the subject of some speculation in offices in downtown Whitehorse. So I thought that at the outset tonight, I would do what some editors do and issue that familiar disclaimer that the opinions expressed here are not necessarily those of the editor. So the opinions that I will express tonight are not necessarily the opinions of the Yukon Indian people, nor are they necessarily the opinions of the Anglican Church or the Lutheran Church, the Presbyterian, Roman Catholic, and United Churches of Whitehorse, nor of the national churches which support Project North. I'd just like to issue that disclaimer. There are a couple of other matters that I'd like to set the record straight on first. One of those is that I do consider myself to be a northerner, although I don't live north of 60 at the moment. I first came here in 1932. I was 6 weeks old, and I stayed here for 10 years. And since then, I have been coming back pretty regularly, and I have lived and traveled in every part of northern Canada that there is. And while I'm not an expert, I do consider myself to be a northerner. My second point is that contrary to some scurrilous and photocopied articles about me circulated by an obscure Edmonton magazine, I have not and never have had any affiliations with any political party or movement in this country. So after having cut myself off from all sources of support, I'll go on now and try to talk about the issues of the evening. Because I'd like to spend some time tonight talking about land claims as they affect other parts of Canada, and of course, as they affect other parts of Canada, how they will ultimately affect the people of the Yukon. Because I think when we talk about land claims in Canada, we're talking about some very, very fundamental principles. We're talking about the struggle for justice. We're talking about the struggle for people's self-respect, for their self-control, their self-realization. And I think that the non-native people of Canada are being challenged by native people across the North to engage with them in this struggle for control of our own lives. I think that the issue of land claims and the settlement of land claims in northern Canada is one of the most important and far-reaching political struggles that this battered and divided nation has faced in some time. The outcome of these land claims, the way in which they're settled, the process that is used to settle them, as well as the actual details of the settlement, could, in my opinion, very well determine the future direction that most of this country will take for many years to come. Because it is a struggle, and those struggles are going on all across the North. Way off in the East, in the Labrador, the Inuit people there have presented the federal government with a land claim which calls for their right to control their own destiny. Just a week ago, the Naskapi and Montagny Indians of central Quebec and the Labrador presented a land claim to Mr. Faulkner which called for their self-determination, and which Mr. Faulkner is reported by the news as having said he viewed with some dismay. In northern Quebec, the Inuit and Cree negotiated the first modern treaty in Canadian history, in the face of one of the most massive development projects this country has ever seen. They negotiated a land claim which they didn't want and which the rest of the Native people of Canada have rejected. The Northwest Territories, the Inuit, are to present on December the 14th a land claim to Mr. Faulkner which calls for their self-determination and the establishment of their political institutions in the Northwest Territories. I presume he will be dismayed by that as well. In the northern British Columbia, the Haida and the Nisga'a have been trying to get the province of British Columbia and the federal government to negotiate with them for more than 100 years. And just 2 weeks ago, the Labor Minister of British Columbia said there was no such thing in this country as Aboriginal rights. And of course, you are all familiar with the struggle of the people of the Yukon. I don't propose in my 15 minutes or so this evening to try and delineate all the precise terms and conditions that each Native organization in Canada is attempting to build into their land claim. That is for the Native people to do, not for me. They are perfectly capable, if they are given the opportunity, of defining the kind of land claim that is appropriate to them. The job of those of us who are non-Native people is to support them in that, not to define it for them. But in going across the country and examining land claims from British Columbia to the Labrador, there are certain common threads which run through them all. And it is those common threads that I would like to spend a few moments on tonight. And the first one can only be defined by using a couple of words which have become very emotional, both in this territory and in other parts of Canada. And that is the issue of colonization and decolonization. Because you can't call it anything else. The Native people of Canada are colonized. And what they are doing in negotiating land claims is going through the painful and difficult but completely necessary process of decolonization. Colonialism has been described by many writers as the theft by one race of another race's culture. And that is what has happened to the Native people of this country. Their culture has been stolen from them by the European race. That theft has resulted in dependency. That theft has resulted in a syndrome of being perpetual losers, of being forced to work and live under a system which is defined by other people, in which your education, your political structures, your cultural institutions, every aspect of your life is defined for you by someone else. And the process of decolonization, the process of regaining one's culture, one's pride, one's independence, is a very painful one. It's like leaving home for the first time, perhaps. It's like cutting the cord. And it's even more painful for the colonizer. It's even more painful for those of us who belong to the dominant society. It's very difficult for us to change our psyche, to change our attitudes from one of doing things to and for people to one of taking our hands off and allowing people to do for themselves. And there's a process of going from dependence to interdependence, in this case within the Confederation of Canada, or the Federation of Canada, whatever it is. And that process means that there has to be a period of complete independence, a period when people can begin to realize again that they are capable of making decisions and taking actions and initiating programs and running their own lives. And that's going to be very painful for those of us who have been the dominant society. And no matter where you go in Canada, where Native people are attempting to settle land claims in a manner that is appropriate to them, you hear the same thing, that they have to go through a period of regaining control of their own lives. That they, the Dene of the Mackenzie, the Inuit of the Northwest Territories, the Naskapi and Montagné of Labrador, the Nishka and the Haida and the Yukon Indian people, they have to define to us what is appropriate for their land claim, and not the other way around. They have told us over and over again, and Daniel repeated it again just a few minutes ago, of their inseparable connection between themselves and their land, and their culture, the spiritual elements of their lives. we have no right to define that for them. And so decolonization, that process of casting off dependency on someone else, on someone else's society and institutions, is a struggle. And it's a struggle that I suggest we must all, if we have any sense of liberation and freedom in our souls, something which we must all engage in. Those struggles, if they are to be viewed with any clarity, with any precision by any of us, must not be viewed in some negative way. Too often we allow others to define that struggle as North versus South, as Native versus White, as development versus stagnation, liberal versus conservative, or whatever. But we must learn to define that struggle in positive terms so that it can be a vehicle for the cultural and political growth through education, through mobilization of people, through their politicization. There can be growth for all of us. And anyone who would deny the Native people of Northern Canada that right which we take for granted, I suggest is guilty of perpetuating the entire colonial and racist oppression which has scarred relations for hundreds of years between the original people of this country and the European newcomers. The Dene, the Nishka, the Inuit, the people of Treaty 9 in Northern Ontario, the Scopi, Montagnier, and others, all have a vision. The details are different. The realities in each area are different. In some places, Native people are in a majority. Some places, they're in a very small minority. But in every case, there are certain things which they say are not acceptable and certain things which they say are essential as elements to their land claim. And every one of them is saying that their Aboriginal rights, that right defined by the Crown in 1763 to the Aboriginal people of all of the British colonies, their Aboriginal rights must not be extinguished. Their land is not for sale for money. Instead, all of those land claims say those Aboriginal rights must be formalized in law, not extinguished, as has been the practice in Canada ever since it became a country. They are saying in every case that appropriate political institutions have to be established that are appropriate to their culture and their way of life and are not imposed upon them by the dominant society. They are saying that their economy, if they are to have political independence, they must have economic and cultural independence as well. And that means the economy of the Native people must be under their control and defined by them. They are saying that if they are to have cultural survival, that their language, their cultural institutions, their spiritual values must also be under their control. That means education. That means religion must be indigenized. They are saying in every case that the endless and depraved round of welfare and alcoholism, which is called dependency, has to end. Those are common threads and many more in the land claims across this country. And in every instance, they add up to that word which causes so much difficulty for so many non-Native people, self-determination. And that's my second point, the second common thread that I see running through all the land claims, and that is the struggle for self-determination. The struggle for self-determination will have such enormous impacts on the whole of this country because it will mean, if it is achieved, the end to racism in Canada. I probably get myself into quite a lot of trouble now. But I think the hard, cold reality is that this country was founded on racism. From the beginnings, the relationship between Native and non-Native was a racist relationship. The only way that the European could justify the appropriation of vast and rich tracts of land was to assume that the original people were inferior beings, incapable of asserting any kind of collective leadership. The European established sovereignty by the ludicrous statement of discovery, implying that there was no one here when Columbus arrived, and implying that it was neither necessary nor desirable to treat with the inhabitants in order to appropriate their land. The original people, being seen as the equivalent of animals, were non-existent under colonial law. And 18 years ago, with great benevolence, the Aboriginal people of Canada were enfranchised. Far too late for it to have any real meaning, because they were so hopelessly outnumbered by then that there was little hope of influencing the political decision-making process. And I believe that today, these same racist fictions of 100 and more years ago remain firmly entrenched and institutionalized in this country. I believe this racist reality is the greatest single barrier I know of to achieving equality and justice for the Yukon Indian people and for any of the other Aboriginal people in Northern Canada. And until that is recognized and named and rooted out, our laws and our institutions and our psyche will continue to make the struggle for equality a hopelessly unequal one. I believe this racism can only be effectively destroyed when we as non-natives, recognize that self-determination, which is the right to control one's life individually and collectively, is the right of all people, and not just the right of the dominant white society. You might ask, what is self-determination? Is it legal? Can it be done in this country? I don't think there is any reason at law why the right of self-determination should not apply to the native people of the Americas. Certainly, there is no justification for denying the identification of the right of self-determination with peoples like the Yukon Indians. The only barrier to self-determination, I suggest, is psychological. The racist tradition, which insisted on the initial denial of the humanity of our Aboriginal peoples, remains intact. And nor is the right of self-determination restricted to the exercise of independence and statehood. The United Nations Declaration on Principles of International Law concerning friendly relations and cooperation among states in accordance with the Charter of the United Nations, Resolution 2625, under the heading, The Principle of Equal Rights and Self-Determination of Peoples, reads as follows, quote, the establishment of a sovereign and independent state, the free association or integration with an independent state, or the emergence into any other political status freely determined by a people, constitutes the mode of implementing the right of self-determination. I think that that is what the Indian people of Canada have always insisted upon, the right to free association with the rest of Canada. They have not been content any longer, I suggest, to live within a racist tradition which suppresses their humanity so as to deny their collective legal existence and thus their right to negotiate land claims. This, I suggest, is the essence of self-determination. And I think that Native people across Canada are articulating that and challenging us to that, and that they are beginning to take all of the legal steps that they can to achieve it within Canada and within the reality within which they live. They have gone about it in many different ways. The Nisga'a have patiently tried to bring the province of British Columbia to the negotiating table because the federal government says there has to be a tripartite form of negotiation. The province of British Columbia has steadfastly refused, probably because of what cost it would bear. The people of the Northwest Territories, who unlike Native people anywhere else in Canada, are in a majority. There are more Native people in the Northwest Territories than there are non-Native, have tried to establish or suggest that there be established some forms of government which would guarantee their majority for years to come, and for their pains have been accused by no one less than the Prime Minister of this country of practicing racism and apartheid. I wonder, when you look at the reservation system in Canada, who is practicing racism and apartheid? Apartheid, if anyone knows anything about it, is the oppression by a majority, the oppression of a majority by a minority. Precisely the opposite pertains in the Northwest Territories, where a majority has told the government that it is prepared to guarantee the rights of a minority, in this case the Europeans, and is prepared to try to govern in such a way as to institute democratic principles among the Native people, the Dene and the Inuit. But the only model that we have for land claims in this country, the only model that we have to end these racist institutions, is something called the James Bay Agreement, something which the federal government has continuously said is going to be some kind of a precedent or model for other land claims, despite the fact that every single Native organization in Canada has rejected that as a model and has rejected the process of negotiating with a gun to your head while massive development projects go unimpeded. The government still insists that the extinguishment, the sale of land, is the only model or the only precedent that is acceptable. It is not possible to have self-determination when the right to that self-determination rests at the good pleasure of a Department of Municipal Affairs of a provincial or territorial government. To a man or to a woman, the Native people of the North have rejected the James Bay. They have rejected the idea of the sale of their land. They have rejected these gun-to-the-head negotiations, and they must be listened to. If they are not, then our generation and our society may well be go down in history as having participated in the cultural genocide of a race of people. My third and final thread, although there are many more, is to ask the question why I and why you, as non-Native people, should get ourselves involved in this struggle. When I have said from the outset that it is not my job to define or negotiate land claims, why then should I not just go away and allow the Native people to do their thing? I believe I should not go away because it's in my best interest, and I suggest in your best interests, the best interest of your children, that the Native people achieve a just and honorable settlement of their land claims by their definition and not by our governments. The struggle for self-determination is my struggle, and I suggest it is your struggle. When I first started to work for Project North, I suppose that I got into this because of the good old-fashioned liberal do-gooderism. It seemed like a good thing to help the underdog, seemed like a good thing to help Native people. As a Christian, I believe that Christians must be on the side of the oppressed, on the side of the victims of injustice. I don't believe we can be neutral. That means we have to be against certain institutions and certain corporations. But as I began to understand more and more about what the principles of decolonization and self-determination were, I began to realize that it was very much in my self-interest that the struggle of the Yukon Indian people for self-determination, that the struggle of the other Native people of the North for self-reliance and equal rights had to be mine. Because in the long run, it will be my rights and my future as well that are at stake. It will be my liberation and my democratic future that is inextricably bound up in the Native people's struggle. And I suggest to you here in the Yukon that in the long run, and we must look in the long run, that economically and politically and in every other way that you can imagine, that a land claim negotiated by the Yukon Indian people freely, without pressure, in their own way and in their own process, allowing them to have political and cultural and economic control of their lives and land, would be in the best interests of all of the Yukon people. I suggest that instead of fighting the land claims, instead of trying to undermine them, instead of viewing them with suspicion, that we should demand of our elected representatives, our federal and our territorial elected representatives, that they give the maximum support that they possibly can to the land claims of the Yukon Indian people and stop trying to thwart them or to undercut them. It seems to me then that any agreement between Canada and the Native people has to be reached freely and as equals. It has to be based on the principle of the recognition of equal rights, especially that right of self-determination, one which we fully enjoy. Native people, it seems to me, are not demanding extraordinary rights, although they are asking for a radical and fundamental change in the historical relationship between Aboriginal people and the rest of the people of Canada. There is no question in my mind that an increasing number of Canadians, and especially Northerners, and especially Yukoners, an increasing number of Canadians are experiencing a sense of powerlessness and alienation, which a chance to vote every 4 years does little to relieve. I am convinced that those same Canadians will, if they are given a chance, and if they give it even the most cursory thought, if they are concerned about the long-term future of the North and its children, that they will support Native people in their struggle to regain their political and cultural and economic rights. And I can only say in closing that a society which chooses to ignore the rights of any of its citizens, whatever the rationalization, including pipelines and including short-term economic booms, a society which ignores those rights simply to enhance the wealth of a few people, that is the kind of society in which the rights of all of us are threatened. I cannot conceive, and I'm quite serious about this, I cannot conceive of any reason sufficiently powerful to justify the continued denial of the rights of the Northern Native people. Thank you very much.